I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We talk now to Corey Parsons. His is an interesting, fascinating, and inspiring story. Mr. Parsons has always had a keen sense of adventure. That, however, was challenged at the age of 23 when a diving accident left him a quadriplegic. It didn't kill the spirit of adventure and hope that he embodies today. He's participated in various sporting competitions, and he's a sought-after speaker, and now the author of a new cookbook, Cooking with Corey, Inspirational Recipes for the Fearless Cook. I see a lot of cookbooks come across my desk, and a number of their famous authors have appeared on this program, but Corey's story begins as cookbook, and it grips you as the book unfolds with delicious and easy-looking recipes that anyone can attempt. His advocacy for healthy, sustainable eating can be gleaned from these pages. His love of cooking is felt throughout. Corey Parsons was born in Kitimat and joins me from Nanaimo, BC, where he lives. His website is at coreyparsons.com. Cooking with Corey is published by Whitecap. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Corey Parsons. Good morning, Mr. Parsons.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, let's give the people listening an overview of your life, and then they can pick up the book and fill in the rest of the story, because people should pick it up, because it's an interesting story. It's a fascinating one. It's an inspiring one. You grew up in you were born in Kitimat, right? Did you grow up there?
No, I spent about a year and a half there, and due to a fire in our home, we were forced to have to move, and the choice was made to move to a small town called Smithers.
Yeah, and then how did you end up in Nanaimo?
My father was transferred for his employment to the island, and when I was about 12 years old, the island was looking like a destination for a young growing man to go and explore, and I love, you know, as it's become apparent to most people, that I love food, and I love the sustainability, and living on an island, we're surrounded by, you know, the most abundant amount of seafood available and freshness. It's right outside the back door, and that really appealed to me to come here and live with him and take in the environment.
See, I live in Vancouver, and then we think, you know, that we have everything here, and I guess that's the same in Nanaimo. We think some people might think that living on an island, you're cut off from stuff. I mean, you can get pretty much anything there, right?
Absolutely. You know, there's nothing you ever need to leave this island for, except maybe to go see a rock concert.
Yeah.
In Vancouver. It's not a small island by any means. I think it takes about 15 hours if you wanted to drive from one end to the other end of this island.
Yeah.
So it is quite large. And it's surrounded on, you know, all four corners with the most sustainable, beautiful, freshest foods and seafoods. And you know, it's a great growing environment too. If you're a type of gardener, and I am, I keep an organic garden every year. And the environment here, as well as the West Coast, Vancouver even, excellent areas for growing, and warm summers and mild winters, and really suits a great sustainable yard.
Now, for your own garden, are you able to grow anything that you want, anything that you need for your kitchen, say?
I grow all of my own vegetables and all my own herbs that I use in my cooking itself. There's a few things that I wish I could grow. I currently have a five-year-old banana tree in my backyard that does not produce bananas per se, but it does produce the big, beautiful, silky leaves that I like to use for plating. Mm-hmm. They look really nice on a plate, and it really sparks people's interest as to, you know, what is this big, green, shiny leaf that's so pretty. But most things I'm able to grow myself. I have a lot of raised beds in the yard, so it's, you know, accessible to me, being that I am in a wheelchair. I don't have to reach down into the dirt. The dirt comes to me.
Yeah.
Just raise them up about 2.5-3 feet, and that allows me just to sit directly beside the beds, do my watering, do my weeding, do my pruning, and harvesting too.
Yeah. Just about the banana leaves, because I was just I went out to get the mail a minute ago, and our neighbor has a banana leaf outside. Is it because of the weather that we can't grow bananas in this part of the world? Because it's not hot enough, or what is that, do you think?
Apparently, from my understanding, because I have been trying to get the darn thing to fruit for me,
yeah.
They need 15 months of frost-free, and we don't get anywhere close to 15 months in a row without having some frost. So the chances of getting bananas are slim to nil, although there is one gentleman in Nanaimo who has hybrided a banana and has, in fact, produced bananas right here on the island.
Hmm. Yeah. Now let's talk about the accident. That was, what, 10, 12 years ago now?
It'll be 13 years this August 1st.
Yeah. So what was the deal there? You were showing off?
I certainly was.
Yeah.
I was in love with a young woman that I'd met the year prior, and we both decided that we'd like to see each other again, and we rendezvoused as per our agreement to see each other 1 year later in the same little small town of Kelowna on the same day 1 year later, and it was magic, and you know, I was completely and totally just enthralled and in love, and it was that maddening, crazy love that just about blinds you, and We wanted to go for a swim, and that blinding love really did blind me. I completely dove between two signs on the beach that said, don't dive here, and I jumped right between them. I dove right between them and hit the bottom with my head and broke my neck subsequently.
Yeah. How long was it after the accident that you knew that you were handicapped, that you were quadriplegic?
About half an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, as soon as I got to the emergency at the hospital, they did an x-ray, and the doctor brought the x-ray in and showed it to me. I was laying on a spine board staring at the light bulbs above me and ceiling tiles, and it was very, very apparent that something severe had happened. I wasn't able to feel anything below my chin, basically, and when he showed me the x-ray, it showed a complete dislocation and a complete burst of the 6 vertebrae.
How do you deal with the loss of that? I mean, I read the book. I've seen you on television. I'm talking to you now. It seems that you've overcome a great deal. What does it take to do that?
Well, I think life is full of adversity, and it's always going to be, you know, some challenge or another. For me, growing up, you know, I had difficulty with reading. I had difficulty hearing. I had many, many surgeries to my ears. Small little sort of things to overcome in light of what I'm dealing with now. But I think it's that drive and determination that you carry with you your whole life to succeed and to do the best you can with what you have. And, you know, I was always up for a challenge. I always loved pushing my boundaries, my limits. My family can attest to that. I think I drove them nuts growing up, but I always tried my hardest at whatever it was I was doing, and this was something, you know, that I felt that I had to not only try for myself, but to also show other people that, you know, there is a life after a life-altering injury like this, and you can be successful and happy, and, you know, there's many positive things that have actually come from my life altering the way it has. I don't necessarily miss being able to walk anymore. I miss being able to use my hands because of my impairment. I don't have voluntary motion of my fingers or my hands. So I do miss being able to use my hands, but I don't necessarily miss walking. That part has been facilitated by the wheelchair and my van, my wheelchair-accessible van, which I drive independently and get around in. But it's definitely brought a different sense of appreciation. That proverbial saying of slow down and smell the roses couldn't be more true. You know, when you don't know what you got till it's gone, and then it's gone, and then some, you really become appreciative of what you do have remaining, and you do the very best you can with what you have left.
I'm reading the book, and as I said, I've read about you online and the sort, and it seems to me that there's nothing that you can't do. Do you think that as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. My one of my little mottos that I like to tell people is that it's never a matter of if, it's only a matter of how. And for me, that was a very, very big moment in my life when I was trying to, there's a small story in the book about me picking up an orange, and that was my biggest challenge post-injury in the occupational therapy department. I went in and I was sitting at the table and in my wheelchair, and she said, you know, here's an orange, pick it up. And because my hands don't work, I couldn't figure out how to pick the orange up. And I started getting upset, thinking, well, what if I can't pick up this orange? And what if this isn't something I'm going to be able to do? Then what am I going to do with myself? And it wasn't until I took a moment to say, you know, almost out loud to my own self, how am I going to pick this orange up? And as soon as I asked myself how, I got engaged in trying to problem solve and find my way through it. And that's carried over into my everyday life with all the different activities I've gotten involved in. I did race in the 2009 World Bathtub Championship races here in Nanaimo. I was the very first quadriplegic to ever participate. And it was a logistic nightmare, to be honest. We had to figure out how I was going to be able to steer it, drive it, be safe. If the boat should, you know, upset, I needed to be able to be, you know, able to survive such a thing. And it was just a matter of how. And it just took a bunch of people getting together and making things happen.
The other message that I got out of the book, I thought quite important, and I should bring it up, is the fact that you're not handicapped, that you're handicapable.
Yes, sir.
That term. That's important that we need to recognize that. Do you find when you interact with people in your life day to day, and you're in a wheelchair, do you find people are uncomfortable, that they don't know how to, say, I don't know, deal with you, talk to you?
I don't necessarily. I don't see that.
Yeah.
I think I make people feel quite at ease, and the comment I'm kind of most handed is, what chair? I don't even see the chair anymore. You know, within 5 minutes of someone speaking with me,
yeah,
they don't even realize that I'm in a chair anymore, or they don't associate it with a disability of any kind.
Did you find that you encounter people who are, say, patronizing or overly sympathetic?
Occasionally. Once in a while, you'll find people who come up and say, oh, look, it's so nice to see you out, and I don't know where they expected me to be, you know, in the closet or something, but,
yeah,
you know, they do slightly patronize, but it's coming from a good place, and I don't take it on as a negative. I take it on as a positive, and I say thank you so much for supporting me, for being out of my proverbial closet or wherever they may have thought I was hiding. But no, I think everyone's intentions are truly, you know, positive, and I do my very best to make people as comfortable as they can be. You know, within their own skin around me, and I don't really feel like I've ever had a problem with that at all.
Have you always cooked?
I've always been involved in the kitchen ever since I was little. I used to get in there with my grandma and help her make bread, and there's a small little story in the beginning of the book about how my bread was all gray because I didn't wash my hands before we started.
Yeah.
Grandma used to always give me heck for that, but always kind of involved in that, and then there was a great little cooking television show called Walk with Jan. A man who was very entertaining, very funny. I'm not even sure I learned how to cook, but he entertained me, and the fact that he was doing it with food and some of the dishes he was coming out with were completely foreign to a meat and potatoes boy. You know, when he was using bamboo shoots and ginger and stuff I'd never even heard of or eaten in my entire life, but it intrigued me. And the commentary and the entertaining side of the way he was projecting himself completely hooked me, and I wanted to be a part of that too.
Did you go to school at all?
For cooking?
For cooking, yeah.
Not for culinary itself. I worked in restaurants since I was about 12 years old, starting as a kitchen helper, prep, dishwasher, all the way up to line cook to grill, basically from the bottom to the top in the back. And then once I kind of made my rounds through the back of the house, I wanted to try the front of the house, so I went out front and started everything from greeting, hosting, busing, to serving, to bartending, to owning and catering.
Do you find that that people, say, who might pick up your book, will do so because they think that they can't cook like you, say? There is this fear that people have in terms of cooking. I mean, they can cook for themselves, they can cook for their family. But I'm reading the book, and I think to myself that a lot of these things in here, you can cook for, say, if you want to have people over and you want to have something nice to serve. And there is a fear there, isn't there?
I think that's one of the reasons why we chose the title Inspirational Recipes for the Fearless Cook.
Yeah.
And that's to inspire people and to hopefully motivate and relate to people that do find cooking a bit intimidating. And this can offer them an opportunity to see me do it with lowered hand function, you know, having to make adaptations, having it take me a little bit longer in the kitchen. But it could also be very motivating to some of them. I've been approached recently by a woman in Victoria when I was doing a signing at the Costco Langford. And she said, you know, my husband wouldn't step foot in the kitchen. And then he saw you on TV, and I bought him the book, and he's read the book, and he's just inspired that if that guy can do it, then what's stopping me? I've got to be able to try this too.
I mean, there are things in here like bouillabaisse and a frittata and you know, these are almost fancy things that the average person, say, wouldn't attempt. But reading the recipes, I mean, I could do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very straightforward. I didn't use any sort of textbook jargon, stuff that people wouldn't understand. I tried not to use too many ingredients that weren't found locally. And the sustainability of the ingredients that I do use generally are found locally. And it's very step-by-step. There's tips all the way through. There's little anecdotes about where the recipes have come from, where they've come from as far as my inspiration, and where you can go with them, too, as far as altering them or changing them should you not like some of the ingredients.
And most of the things take a reasonable amount of time. Like, I was looking at the bouillabaisse, and you can do that in about an hour, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I also looked at the copyright page, and I noticed that you did the food styling for the book. So you actually cook all these things that we see, the photographs of the dishes, you cooked those and plated those?
I absolutely did, and I did 52 of them in 2 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a lot of help, and I put air quotes around the help part.
Uh-huh.
I had people doing dishes for 2 days straight. I had a little bit of help with some of the prep, and I definitely had a lot of help with eating all of the food once it was all made. All of the recipes that I made for the shoot, the actual photography, the 2 photography days, I made them adhering directly to the recipes themselves. So if it says it cooks or serves 4, then I made it for 4.
Really?
Yeah. And there was quite a bit of prep and organization, you know, to have 52 dishes done in 2 days. Took every bit of my energy and skill in the kitchen to, you know, allocate these out one after the other. I did a hot dish, then a hot dish, cold dish, and that gave the photographer time to shoot the hot one while I prepped the cold one, and when he was shooting the cold one, I was firing the hot one. And we just worked together, we communicated really, really well, and, you know, I think it was a really great success. There's a photo, I believe it's one of the early photos in the book, where I'm sitting in the middle of my street, and my arms are out at my sides, and I'm screaming my head off.
Mm-hmm.
And that photo signifies the end of the last photo. And when I finished the last dish, we zoomed out to the middle of the street on a very busy road. And I don't recommend that, by the way, but we took some really great photos of me out there just in a triumphant scream, you know, just a primal yell of this overcoming this incredible marathon.
Is there something in the book that you enjoy cooking all the time?
Most of the dishes I enjoy cooking all of the time. You know, I don't necessarily adhere to, this might sound really crazy, but I don't always adhere to the recipe.
Yeah.
I see recipes as a guideline or as a bit of a, you know, a motivation. I don't see it as you have to follow it because that's the way it is. They're all, you know, open to interpretation and to people's own tastes and likes and dislikes. But yeah, the frittata, you know, is kind of like a Sunday morning. We quite often have that, my girlfriend and I, and, you know, we might switch out the asparagus for some spinach or some pea shoots or, you know, I've got chickens on my property right now. We've got 8 chickens, and they produce organic eggs for us, and it's such a treat to just take a walk down the hill. My air quotes again, I'm walking.
Mm-hmm.
Down the hill to get the eggs from the chickens and bring them back, you know, and they're still warm. And you crack them in a pan, and they don't move. They're just beautiful and yellow, and it's just a real treat to have this right in my own backyard.
In the book, you talk about the sort of salt that you use, and
yes.
We hear experts on the sort telling us that we need to lower our salt intake or sodium intake. For you, high salt intake resulted in twitches, you said?
extremely painful spasticity.
Yeah.
Yeah, any kind of processed salts. The most notable evil was an experience I had with MSG.
Right.
And it was in a packaged product of a processed salt, and it caused me incredible pain and spasticity for a number of days, where I wasn't able to sleep or eat or actually even manage wheeling my wheelchair due to the level of spasticity. It was all I could do to just basically hang on to the chair and not hit the floor. And I've subsequently swapped over all of my seasonings and salts for this Himalayan pink salt under the brand name Salt of Life. And it's an incredibly great product. They're finding a lot of new information about that particular type of Himalayan pink salt, being that we have 86 carbons in our blood, and the salt shares exactly 86 with our blood. So I don't know how much that means in the culinary circles, but all I know is that it really enhances food, and I don't get the negative side effects from processed sodium.
And the taste is, you said that it enhances the food, and it tastes, I guess, it tastes, well, what does it taste like? Does it taste like normal salt, or?
You know, it's an interesting thing, because you tell people, you know, it doesn't taste salty, but it's salt, and people look at you like you're crazy. It has an ability to bring out the flavor of food, and one of the examples that we'll do at a show is we'll use a couple pieces of cucumber, and we'll put cucumber into a little bit of iodized table salt like you would find at any restaurant or home.
Yeah.
And then we'll put a little bit of the Himalayan pink salt on a piece of cucumber. And the iodized salt tastes salty. It kind of burns your tongue. It's not an enjoyable experience with this cucumber. And then when you do exactly the same thing with the Himalayan pink salt, suddenly this cucumber is screaming in your mouth. You don't even taste the salt. All you taste is more cucumber.
Saltoflife.ca. That's the website if you want to look that up. What's next for you, Corey? What's the next adventure after this book?
The next adventure, I think, I'm going to be doing a lot of speaking engagements. I'm hoping to use the book as a bit of a stepping stone to perhaps get onto maybe the Food Network and start cooking on television. I do love entertaining. I love entertaining my friends. I recently just built a home with a fully custom wheelchair accessible kitchen with over 12 foot of an island that I can have about 6 or 8 people sit around and actually do a small little cooking demo or a class. You know, hopefully if all things work out the way I hope that they are going to, we'll see another book, a second edition of Cooking with Corey.
This is a great book, Corey. I've enjoyed the conversation today and the book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much, Joe. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. The website for more, CoreyParsons.com. The book is called Cooking with Corey, Inspirational Recipes for the Fearless Cook. It's published by Whitecap. Its author, Corey Parsons, on the line from Nanaimo. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.